Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder. This was the Learning College. Today we're going to do The Feminization of American Culture, and we're going to do Chapter 2. And I don't know if we're going to... Oh, I'm sorry, it's Chapter 1, because we did the introduction, which is up to page 13, and we're going to do all or as much of Chapter 1 as I feel is appropriate. It's a pretty long chapter, but... This is a particularly, I've been looking forward to this one for quite a while. This is a very important book written by a feminist, a self-described feminist back in the 70s named Anne Douglas. And she was intellectually serious, and she notices her theme. I'm going to read the last page, the last few paragraphs of the end of the introduction so that we get back in the mindset from when we started this book. Okay, and what we're going to do is The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, 1977, Part 1, The Sentimentalization of Status, and Chapter 1 is Clerical Disestablishment. That's what we're going to do today. And the point here is the decline in the intellectual quality and the moral rigor of the old Protestant set who founded the U.S., at least the founders from the northeastern part of the U.S., they typically slight the more southern founders. Their decline from a very serious class that founded the universities and provided genuine moral leadership and self-examination into, she would say, the decline of the patriarchy, but it's not replaced by anything equally rigorous. She believes, perhaps without considering that rigor is tied to the patriarchy, that you can have the end of the patriarchy, and that's a good thing, but it's a bad thing that it's not replaced by something equally rigorous, but I suppose egalitarian or feminist or feminine. So she does see that something is lost, and that puts her miles ahead of any feminist in today's world, because they would say there's nothing good about whiteness or masculinity or feminine, or well, maybe femininity too, but certainly nothing good about any this old-time system. It's just getting better when you get rid of men and you're continually mocking the men who created civilization. But it never even occurs to them that they not might not, and I'm not sure, as I say, that it even occurs to Douglas that women may not be capable. They may be capable of functioning successfully within that patriarchal system by its standards, as she is one who meets the patriarchal standards, because her volume is a serious intellectual work, unlike the works of many feminists these days, but it may not be clear to her that women are incapable of founding their own alt system, as it were, their own competing system, or even just any kind of different system. They're simply, as Florence King said, the heavy presence of women in an institution is a sign of its decline. And that's a view Anne Douglas, of course, would not even consider because of her own feminist ideology. But this is really, I don't need to sell this book, it's an excellent book. And it has a lot to say about the source of liberalism in America, which tracing the decline over the 19th century that led to the state of things when Jews arrived in large numbers at the end of the 19th century and start of the 20th century to pick up and run from there. So this book is kind of how America was transformed from a successful, masculine, logical enterprise into a feminist, emotional, mass consumerist culture. And that's where Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique picks up in the 1900s with Franz Boas and Horace Kallen, and the trashing of anthropology and the formal lying and the taking over the educational institutions, or more, which is more typically the working together, the coming together of the WASP elite and their agenda with the new found Jews and their agenda. And in a way, they work together. In a way, the Jews pass them like a ship during the night. As I've often said, F. Scott Fitzgerald notices this in his novels in the first decades of the 20th century. Anyway, let's read the last page of the introduction again, just to put us back in the mindset. Now, everything that we tape is at vnnforum.com. We did the introduction, and this will be the first time we returned to it since then. We've had a lot of intervening stuff in the middle, but I want to get back to this because it's a super important point in understanding how America got to be the way it is. She says, page 12, "The sentimentalization of theological and secular culture was an inevitable part of the self-evasion of a society both committed to laissez-faire industrial expansion and disturbed by its consequences." So love-hate with the populating and building up the new continent. America, impelled by economic and social developments of international scope, abandoned its theological modes of thought at the same time its European counterparts abandoned theirs. It lacked, however, the means they possessed to create substitutes. American culture, younger and less formed than that of any European country, had not yet developed sufficiently rich and diversified secular traditions to serve as carriers for its ongoing intellectual life. And remember, the educational institutions in the U.S., the colleges like Harvard, are all found by their various Protestant sects that came over here. But then subsequently they still may retain chaplains and preachers and what have you in official capacities, but they're not so established as they were from, say, 1620 up to 1803 was, I believe, when the change took place at Harvard, which is usually considered the most significant change, or the sort of the bellwether for setting the pace or the trend for the 1900 or the 1800s as we move out of the colonial period to the independence, to the secularization, the buildup of large population, the industrial revolution, the growth of the middle class, women having leisure where the men are away and kind of forming an alliance with the preachers who are not these hard, old, rigorous sinners in the hands of an angry God, moral lecturers and genuine strong man leaders of their community, but who are more these weaselly, suck-up-y, obsequious, servile preachers who see women as more of their clients or their customer base than those who require their moral tutelage. You see the difference? That's kind of the changing character of the preacher as a position and as a man filling that position, and the people he related to who are more the women. And this is kind of at odds with the greater masculine trend in economics and greater American society. And this all is what she's talking about through the course of the book. The feminization of American culture, remember? And so she says, America didn't have the secular traditions to carry on its ongoing intellectual life. The pressures for self-rationalization of the crudest kind were overpowering in a country propelled so rapidly toward industrial capitalism with so little cultural context to slow or complicate its course. Sentimentalism provided the inevitable rationalization of the economic order. In the modernization of American culture that began in the Victorian period, some basic law of dialectical motion, that would be thesis, antithesis, synthesis, as it moves forward, that's Hegelian, and you see that in Marx. Some basic law of dialectical motion was disrupted, unfulfilled, perhaps disproved. Calvinism was a great faith with great limitations. And that's the old school, hard-ass Protestantism. Calvinism was a great faith with great limitations, and it's associated with capitalism. It was repressive, authoritarian, dogmatic, patriarchal to an extreme. Its demise was inevitable, and in some real sense, welcome. Today's feminists would say in every sense its demise was welcome. Yet it deserved, and elsewhere at other times found, great opponents. One could argue that the logical antagonist of Calvinism was a fully humanistic, historically minded Romanticism. Exponents of such Romanticism appeared in mid-19th century America. One thinks particularly of Margaret Fuller and Herman Melville. But they were rare. In America, for economic and social reasons, Calvinism was largely defeated by an anti-intellectual sentimentalism. That's a woman saying, oh, that's not nice. She's not saying it's illogical or it's wrong or you've drawn the wrong conclusion. She's saying it's not nice. And this is the policy. Look at how that applies to politics and race relations and things like that. We get angrier about not what niggers do, but angrier about people calling them niggers. This is the sign of a weak society. It's too weak to face the truth about things. So it takes recourse to what she's calling sentimentalism. But in political terms, it's evasions, it's dishonesty, it's a portion of political correctness, at least among those evasions of people who prefer something other than reality, whether they know what they're doing or they're simply avoiding it, as most women are avoiding anything, if the Jews would style us controversial, because there's social danger there. And this is real character weakness. Or you could say it's just women being women. The problem is that men are now acceding to women, and somehow that became the cultural norm. And that's what turns up in the 20th century with the idea of this doofus as dad. Or dad's always an idiot who's just there to provide the money. God damn. Sorry for that. I really truly mean to mostly refrain from swearing in these because I want them to be listened to for a long time. Calvinism was largely defeated by an anti-intellectual sentimentalism. I've actually got that underlined in my copy. Anti-intellectuals, isn't that, that's not nice. Don't call him a nigger. That's not nice. Pervaded by men and women whose victory did not achieve their finest goals. America lost its male-dominated theological tradition. So it's basically, think of like, to personalize it, think of like Jonathan Edwards, who the most famous sermon ever given in America, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You know, basically why God doesn't throw moral lepers like you into the burning pits of hell, I have no idea. It is only his mercy that stayeth his hand, you know. From that hardcore masculinity, that serious working with Bible verses and seriously as possible, and these were very learned men, serious morality, serious intellectualism, giving way to someone like Joel Osteen, you know, a big grinner, a guy who's more concerned with what's in the collection plate and getting his teeth re-upped on their whitening than about the moral soul of the people he's dealing with. And basically Christianity dissolves into feminine niceness, and there's no moral rigor to it. There's mercy and love, but there's no justice. You see, it's like exactly the analogy always leaps to mind of a body without a spine. It's just a bunch of flesh pool on the floor. Does not work ultimately, and now we're enjoying the collapse because of the decline of that moral rigor. Insistent. That's why I always insist on principles. I mean, I'm trying, as a result of reading like books like this and thinking about what the white race needs and what the white culture needs, I try to provide some of this. And it's necessary. It has to come. That sternness or that rigor or that principledness has to come from somebody. Without it, you really don't get anywhere. Now, Calvinism was largely defeated by an anti-intellectual sentimentalism pervaded by men and women whose victory did not achieve their finest goals. America lost its male-dominated theological tradition without gaining a comprehensive feminism or an adequately modernized religious sensibility. It is crucial that I be, and again, she's assuming that there's no necessary connection between patriarchy and this rigor. That she is an unusual feminist, more typical of the early, more serious feminist, even up to the 70s, desired. She's assuming that feminists can come up with their own, but it's not so clear that they can, since they never have. She says, I want to be, it is crucial that I be as clear as I hear as I can. The tragedy of 19th century Northeastern society is not the demise of Calvinist patriarchal structures, but rather the failure of a viable, sexually diversified culture to replace them. Feminization, in quotes, inevitably guaranteed not simply the loss of the finest values contained in Calvinism, but the continuation of male hegemony in different guises. The triumph of the feminizing sentimental force, and remember, feminizing doesn't mean women taking over, it means something basically womanly. A man can be womanly as well as a womanly, and that's what she's saying. We didn't get a good feminist rigorous thing to replace the patriarchy. What we got were these weaselly, oily men working with these soft, cosseted middle-class women. So not really, we lost something, and what we gained wasn't necessarily all that great. She's aware of this. And that's one reason we can respect her, even if we draw a different conclusion or we entertain assumptions that I don't think she's willing to entertain. Again, the tragedy of 19th century Northeastern society is not the demise of Calvinist patriarchal structures, but rather the failure of a viable, sexually diversified culture to replace them. So she has the ideal of kind of egalitarian. Men and women can be equal partners, but they really can't. They're not equally suited to certain things. They may be complementary, but they're not equal. Feminization, in quotes, inevitably guaranteed not simply the loss of the finest values contained in Calvinism, but the continuation of male hegemony in different guises. The triumph of the feminizing, again in quotes, sentimental forces that would generate mass culture. Mass, so think of that, redefined and perhaps limited the possibilities for change in American society. So we became an anti-intellectual culture, a sentimental culture, a mass culture where ideas and ultimately reading books was something the queer and weird. And it's all about how you feel and attitudinizing. Then the Jews turned this into political correctness, the Semitical correctness, in reality, in the 20th century, given this substrate. But now we're talking about how the substrate was created. And this was the transformation of the particular type of Christianity we had that founded the country, at least in the Northeast. And since it created and ran the public schooling system, which was created in the latter half of the 1800s, the pattern that dominated the country after the Civil War, we are learning how that substrate was formed. We're learning how the creation of the playing field that the Jews came onto after 1900. So the triumph of the feminizing sentimental forces that would generate mass culture. So mass culture was generated by feminizing sentimental forces. So even that whole TV thing where mom is always right and the chictator and the woman is the boss and the man follows along and is always upbraided and snubbed by his own kids and his own disrespected by his own wife, that was laid in this culture. Back then it wasn't as crude, but it had its origins, the woman always being right and the notion of the woman as more moral than the man, which was preached not just in the U.S. but in England as well. So, you understand. She says here, the triumph of the feminizing sentimental forces that would generate mass culture, redefined and perhaps limited the possibilities for change in American society. But again, this is all before TV and the whole electronic culture, and indeed, it's even before the Industrial Revolution, a lot of it. Or more or less, it's simultaneous with it. Concomitant with it. Sentimentalism, with its tendency to obfuscate the visible dynamics of development, that is basically escape into evasion about what's really going on, heralded the cultural sprawl that has increasingly characterized post-Victorian life. I don't think it's particularly easy to understand what she means by that. She could be a little clearer. Obfuscate the visible dynamics of development. I mean, we can see the obfuscation of the visible dynamics of forced racial mixing in the riots and the way that they're misrepresented systematically. Black crime is misrepresented by the Jewish media. And that whole what is going on and also the explanation of what is going on, the problem and the meta problem are both obscured from the white perspective, which is what we're here to provide you. Anyway, that's how she wraps up her introduction, and that's where we had left off last time. I wanted to re-go over that because I think it's very important. And now we'll move into part one, the sentimentalization . It's a three-part book, and part one has three chapters: clerical disestablishment, feminine disestablishment. 3, ministers and mothers changing and exchanging roles. So we're going to do clerical disestablishment today. Chapter 1, clerical disestablishment. Think about that. You know, in established churches, that's what she's referring to. More specifically, you know, when you had these small groups of people coming to the U.S. in these rickety boats, landing there, setting up communities that are under the direction of one man, who's usually more or less of a dictator, and he's usually going to be some kind of a preacher, because that's why they're coming there, a religious community, seeking their own freedom to worship the way they want to. So this is the origin, and out of all this, as the numbers slowly grow, they establish their basic institutions, finally including universities. And these are specific religious universities, because the religion is tied to education at this point. It's not until the start of the 1800s, they really, when Harvard is kind of disestablishes its chair, where they formally break free and become more secular institutions. And this is the big story. And there's also at the same time a decline of rigor, which is highly suggestive, even to a feminist. So, she says, Chapter 1, Clerical Disestablishment, A Crisis of Self-Confidence. Henry James Sr., a religious maverick of no little, remember, education of Henry Adams, that's a different one. Henry James is the novelist. Henry James Sr., a religious maverick of no little waywardness and no less astuteness, judged that American Protestantism in the mid-19th century was in a sad state of decline, so mid-1800s. In his words, quote, "Religion in the old virile sense, the masculine, manly sense, has disappeared and been replaced by a feeble Unitarian sentimentality. Jesus without the sacrifice, or the God part, is just secular, just be nice." And then later, 50 years later after that, after the period he's describing or lamenting the decline, it turns into social gospel, which is forget focusing on the other world, focus on this world and help the little brown brothers and be socialist rather than individualist and laissez-faire. So it turned into something absolutely terrible, and it wasn't anything that great to start with. Ha, that's my opinion. Like most such sweeping generalizations, this is, of course, an oversimplification. Again, the quote was, "Religion in the old virile sense has disappeared and been replaced by a feeble Unitarian sentimentality." Unitarians, you'll find, there were a number of them at higher-end universities, and they're kind of like, they're still kind of Christian, but they're basically Christianity deprived of any soul or spirit, and they're just this like, like running on ethers when you're out of gas, you know, trying to coast in the next town. But they may be powerful and connected people for all that, and they often are. And rich, it's not a low-end denomination. Okay, she says, okay, this could be a generalization or oversimplification, but yet it is one worth examining, if only because it expresses an opinion shared by many of James's most intelligent contemporaries on a subject of vital concern to them, the changing nature of America's Calvinist heritage. James is indirectly making several very interesting points here. He surely knew that Unitarianism, an offspring of Congregationalism, had proved itself an extremely limited and even unpersuasive religious movement almost within decades of its inception in late 18th century, 1700s, New England. He is implying, nonetheless, that its, quote, feeble, unquote, and sentimental sensibility has pervaded or supplanted other forms of faith. So don't be fooled by outward forms, even though outwardly this is a religion that has started late and has few adherents and may even be dying out. Nevertheless, the spirit that it either started or embraced has spread widely and been contagious to the general Christian mindset throughout the Northeast and the country, since the Northeast is dominating the country pretty much the whole way. He is implying that its feeble and sentimental sensibility has pervaded or supplanted other forms of faith. Moreover, he suggests that Unitarianism is not itself a religion, but rather a kind of cultural substitute for religion. I can't believe it's not butter. It's not butter. It looks like butter. It's colored like butter. It's not butter. It even says so in the title, man. He suggests that Unitarianism is not itself a religion, but rather a kind of cultural substitute for religion. Hence, its triumph has been a victory for the forces of secularization. Or secular humanism, as the right-wing Christians rather than the left-wing feminist would say. Finally, although clearly with no special thought or design, James finds it natural to talk of this process in what might be called sexual terms. He is saying that religion has been emasculated. Good stuff, good stuff. One needs to be careful in recording the sexual reverberations of words uttered by pre-Freudian, that's pre-1900, Victorians, but it seems more than coincidental that post-Freudian historians, writing of the vitiation, the weakening, of the New England Calvinism, to which James is referring, have used language charged with similar connotations. Basically, this religion's been deballed. The priest won't ever dare. Like I've said in politics, the last person who dared to morally lecture people was probably Bobby Kennedy. Because nowadays, the only way you get ahead is by pandering to people. And this is a more effeminate way of smoothing over feelings and trying to appeal to people and appease them and make them feel good rather than, I don't know what you want, but I know what you need. It's one of my dad's favorite sayings. But, the loss of masculine rigor and masculine confidence to say, look, you know, you can be your squirrely, scatterbrained self all you want, but here's the freaking problem you have. Here's what you need to do. Doesn't matter how you feel about it. You can keep your feelings behind your teeth for all I'm concerned. Here's the problem. Here's what needs to be done. Either you do it or you don't. Anything else is just blah, 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 blah. And so these people are starting to see there's been a serious cultural decline reflected in the change from hardcore religion to this feminized gunk. And Unitarianism is the source of a lot of this feminized gunk. And I've heard that firsthand. I've observed that firsthand. The only libertarian, I think I've mentioned that before, the only Unitarian I ever knew was a cute girl in college. And she was a big fan of that sort of left-wing gunk. Although a very attractive individual in many ways. These critics, so he's saying that James is not the only one saying this. A lot of them said this is similar things. These critics, the Niebuhr brothers, N-I-E-B-U-H-R, again, remember, I-E in German is E. The Niebuhr brothers, chief among them, denounced the liberalism which had defeated the sterner Orthodox creed as sentimental, and condemned its persistent refusal to face the tragic nature of reality. In his seminal book, The Kingdom of God in America, Richard Niebuhr, N-I-E-B-U-H-R, mocked the intellectual falsities and namby-pambiness of such facile theology by scornfully summing up its underlying credo. A God without wrath brought man without sin into a kingdom without judgment, through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. You know, the rose without the thorn. Niebuhr's accusation, with its implicit suggestion of a failure of nerve, is one that easily, and you see how that would relate to political correctness today in the way you can't find any white male politician who will call a spade, who will speak the truth about black crime and about Jewish cover-up and legal facilitation of those crimes. And the whole ghastly thing that's going on is symptomatic indeed of a lack of nerve. Niebuhr's accusation, with its implicit suggestion of a failure of nerve, is one that easily interlaces itself with sexual insinuations. Winthrop Hudson, an able historian of American Protestantism, could have been elaborating on Niebuhr's thought when he explained that, quote, traditional theological insights were emasculated by prominent 19th-century liberal thinkers. Perry Miller, praising the dynamic and imperious New York revivalist Charles Grandison Finney, F-I-N-N-E-Y, the bête noir, that is the really hated one, the most hated one, hated enemy of his early 19th-century liberal brethren, described himself in terms which come close to equating religious and sexual prowess. Finney was, quote, demonic, unquote, quote, among the evangelicals, he was a Napoleon among his marshals. Only that other driving revivalist among Finney's contemporaries, Lyman Beecher, approached him in Miller's mind. Only he was, quote, man enough for the job, unquote, Finney performed. There's a palpable masculine bias in these statements, an unexplored assumption that virility and more general worthiness are roughly synonymous. Yet I am interested in the persistent reappearance of such language, less for the proof it provides of sexual prejudice distorting the business of historical analysis than for its potential usefulness as in its itself historical evidence of a special, if difficult, and not always reliable kind. And again, these are simply her biases. We don't need her to, she's observing and recording and bringing us the facts. We can draw our own conclusions, which is that these guys are right. When the real men go out of preaching, the real manliness goes out of the doctrine. And the oiliness, I just love everybody. Family is whatever you want it to be. And you know what? And here's the one that will hurt for some of you. I love tradition. What is fucking tradition? Tradition, there is no tradition. There are traditions. And they are subject to rational review. And if you say otherwise, you know what? You're wrong, buddy. You're wrong. Which tradition? Cannibalism used to be a tradition. Christianity wasn't a tradition among our people until they chopped off a bunch of heads and then it became the tradition. So does that make it traditional? At what point does it become traditional? How many generations? Are we free to chop off other people's heads and start our own neo-Odinism or something? And then that becomes... You see, it's one of those things that sounds good in the people when you're at a remove. But when you're up close, you can see that it's not what it's advertised to be. It's a mirage. Tradition as a concept is a mirage. The reality of the world is that human civilization is built on the backs of basically a handful of people who had breakthrough insights. Now, it may be true that that handful would not exist without the broader mass of people, but yet it's still true that they have nothing whatsoever. I mean, I look around. What am I looking at here? I'm looking at like a computer I couldn't build. I couldn't figure out how to do. I'm looking at a little digital camera. I couldn't figure out how to make that. I'm looking at a freaking tin can full of rubber bands. Do I know how to make a rubber band? Fuck, I have no idea how to make a rubber band. I'm looking at, an old tin can. Do I know how to make a can and coat it with some kind of special lining so that the whatever was inside it, you know, didn't rot? Hell no, I don't know how to do that. You think I'd figure that out in 100 lifetimes? Hell no. And I'm at least in the upper 2-3% of intelligence and pure IQ. So you see, civilization is basically a tiny percentage of people, and we are all free riding on them like so many niggers on a watermelon truck. And I think that needs to be appreciated. That's why we need the gratitude and the humility. Well, I do have to say about the rubber bands that once in my life I bought rubber bands and they all broke fairly easily. That pissed me off. That's neither here nor there, really. Let's read this again. I just enjoy this. There's palpable masculine bias in these statements, an unexplored assumption that virility and more general worthiness are roughly synonymous. Yet I am interested in the persistent reappearance of such language, less for the proof it provides of sexual prejudice. How is it sexual prejudice? There weren't women preaching, so how could it be prejudice? It's an honest contention that you need to consider honestly, but being feminist, they think that by calling it it's prejudice proves that it's wrong. Prejudice is just you applying some adjective to it. It's not. It doesn't have any inherent objective meaning. Then less for the proof it provides of than distorting the business of historical analysis than for its potential usefulness as itself historical evidence of a special, if difficult and not always reliable, kind. The language, first of all, highlights an obvious historical fact. American Calvinism possessed in the 17th and 18th centuries, the 1600 to 1800, and lost in the 19th, lost in the 1800s, a toughness, a sternness, an intellectual rigor, which our society then and since has been accustomed to identify with masculinity, in some not totally inaccurate if circular sense. So that's as good as a blanket outright admission you're ever going to get any time from feminist everywhere that, look, man, this The whole like reality and its interpretation and making things out of it is basically a masculine deal and a masculine gig. She knows it. But yet women are capable of achieving within that system. It was just why we're bothering time reading this long book. It's 504 pages, including, you know, the index. Because women, but it, women are unlikely to create the form, but they can fulfill within the form. Yeah, once in a, you know, in a Coon's age, that you have an outlier who's capable of some kind of genuine intellectual or artistic achievement. Women do have stuff to perform other than kuka, kinder, kirka, you know, church women and kitchen, church, and kids. The old, I think that was a Kaiser's expression. They are capable of intellectual work. Mostly it's parrot-type stuff or trained labor, but they're not going to be super original or creative, but that's okay. They are capable of doing things other than having and raising children. She says, I'm going to read that again. The language, first of all, highlights an obvious historical fact. That's a feminist saying this, an obvious historical fact. American Calvinism possessed in the 17th and 18th centuries and lost in the 19th a toughness, a sternness, and intellectual rigor which our society then and since has been accustomed to identify with masculinity in some not totally inaccurate, if circular, sense. Saying they're the same thing, like rigor and masculinity and patriarchy and solid intellectualism are the same thing, and the public rightly identifies women with softness and mercy and lack of clarity. And that goes right to the penis and the vagina, the hard, straight-line, linear penis, and the soft, yielding, moist vagina. And do you think it's an accident that that's reflected in the psychology of the being as well as the physical orifice or organ? Interesting, isn't it? I mean, think about it. Is there any inherent reason that women couldn't be the logical, direct, straight-minded sex and men be the sort of shallow, emotional one? I don't suppose there's any inherent reason, but it's not like that. Their sexual organ mirrors the mind, and the sexual organ of the woman mirrors the mind. Interesting. You see all these parallels. Men are lines, right? That's what phallocentric and obelisk, like Washington Monument, is an erect penis. Women are ovals and circular. That's why it's Mother Nature. It's organic. It's cyclic phases like the moon, right? Circular. Versus the rational is always right angles and square and antiseptic, hard, linear. And we need a little of both, you know, just like you need to just eat your steak by itself. You need a potato and you need some vegetables and some sauces. Now, you know, I killed 8 green worms. In this thing, everything is adapted to its purpose. We've had a monstrous amount of rain here in the Nemo, and yesterday I was out plucking and squishing. I was carrying on a proud Germanic peasant tradition of my grandmother, which is to catch insects and smash them between her fingers. Without any of this modern betitted squeamishness, so affects or affects many affected women, women affect to affect. And I was plucking off I try to do a few new things each year in the garden, and this year I got a little broccoli plant, and by God, it was half eaten. It's not even half grown, and it's half eaten. And by God, you know, even though my eyes don't work that great, I finally spotted these loathsome little worms, little green worms. They're the exact same color as the leaves. And by God, I got 6 of them, then I went back out, and I got 2 more. And I squished them all, that the broccoli might grow. And the point is that nature adapts everything to its purpose. It's no coincidence that these worms are exactly the same color as the foliage they're munching on. Think about it. All right, now. So, Calvinism was great, 1600 to 1800, but then 1800 and 1900 really declined into something soft and wet. It became pussified. And this is a goddamn feminist saying this. It's not just me saying it. It's basically the men of the time saying it. This feminist in 1970 saying it, and me saying it in 2015 as I'm reading this to you, just to locate us in time and space. We're on planet Earth, and it's June 15th, 2015. Year of your Lord, 2015. He's not mine, but he is yours, maybe. Anyway, moreover, totally not totally inaccurate. How backhanded can she be? Moreover, in lamenting the vanished virility of Protestantism, critics like James or Miller have hardly stood alone. It is essential to realize that, consciously or not, they are echoing the self-condemnation of the men most involved. So even those oily replacers, those artful dodgers who came in, those sly seducers, those appealers to women, those gigolos of the spirit, those lounge lizards who try to pick up old women in their 80s, they knew what they were up to and they knew what they were. Jim Rockford, you know what you are. You do, right? She's saying even they themselves knew that they were pussies compared to the ones that came before them. Self-condemnation is her term rather than pussy. No one, past or present, has accused liberal Protestantism of effeminacy more seriously or more frequently than the 19th century liberal ministers themselves. For the moment, leaving aside the question of on what grounds, valid or otherwise, their fears were based, let us look at the self-image of the Victorian liberal clergy. These ministers, usually Unitarians, sometimes non-evangelical Congregationalists, did not deny the genuinely progressive elements in their faith. They produced their share of active reformers, and even while they might lament that the vanished stern virtues of their predecessors, they considered themselves benefactors to the human race for their softened reinterpretation of the Calvinist creed. One Sunday in 1838, Charles Follen, F-O-L-L-E-N, 1796 to 1842, so the first half of the 1800s, a German-born Unitarian minister and a courageous advocate of a genuinely liberalized culture, had a, quote, vision, unquote, as he was sitting in an empty church. His vision dramatized the considerable and justifiable optimism present in his wing of Protestantism throughout the 19th century. Follen saw a band of pilgrim fathers, quote, stern worshippers from another world, as he described them. And remember, that this would already be 200 plus years before when these people first came to the U.S. So we think of this as, it's kind of lumps together in our minds because it's long before our age. But think about it. Even in 1825, say, Plymouth Rock and all that crap is 200 years before. See, I think it's easy to forget how long a period that actually is. So this German-born minister, Unitarian guy, is sitting there, has a vision. He sees the stern worshippers from another world, the Pilgrim Fathers, displaced by a group of 19th-century Sunday school children, innocently unaware of their ancestors' presence. The children's victory is effortless, for the Calvinists are apparently pleased to surrender. Quote, here and there a smile passing over their stern features seemed like the reflection of the bright countenances of the little intruders as they stepped into the places of their great forefathers. The floor of the church was swarming with children. To complete this symbolic transfer of power from the sinners of the hands of an angry God to the Jesus loves little children of the world, as it would become in the 20th century, an eagle perched proudly on the pulpit, his wings filled with, quote, glittering swords and muskets, his eyes fixed upon the morning sun and refulgent with the pious daring of the forefathers, you know, striking out for a new land, is miraculously replaced by the gentle form of a dove, who finally flies off to heaven, borne upward on the Sabbath chorus of the children. Follen's view is positive. Love and freedom have triumphed over fear and repression. Yet the picture he paints actually confirms rather than contradicts Henry James's analysis. The conscious force of church authority has given way to the unconscious influence of domestic affection. Adult politics have succumbed to infantile piety. Ecclesia to a nursery. Masculinity is vanquished in the congregation, and even more significantly, masculinity is vanquished in the pulpit. And honest to God, even though you know I'm as irreligious as they come, I'm as anti-God, that is always what VNN tried to supply, and it did through the unique medium of humor, but always with intellectual rigor, because we expressed our principles and we did not deviate from them like almost everybody else does, except the ruling Jews. And that is no accident. That is one thing. If we weren't predisposed to be this way innately, we would have learned from the Jews, in the sense that I always say of taking your tips from winners. You can be flexible in the tactics and the approach, but your basic agenda and whatever, your basic principle, the way you're going to act should be set, that you're reliable to others and they can actually believe you when you say things and when you point in a certain direction. And so it may sound nice, this overt, oh, look, nice little kids replacing these stern moral leaders of the community, but in actuality, there's a downside and a dark side, and even this feminist can see that. Here was the rub. Few of Fallon's contemporaries, as we move on to page 20, whatever their attitudes toward the liberalization of their theology, were able to rejoice as wholeheartedly as he did over their own metamorphosis from eagle to dove. We are learning nothing new about American culture when we discover that a male in the 19th century, like one in the 20th, self-convicted of feminine qualities, was usually also troubled by anxiety that he might be a failure, non-functional, even non-existent. There were notable exceptions, Fallon chief among them, but it is safe to say that over the course of the 19th century, the liberal minister experienced increasing difficulty respecting his own vocation. A note of self-depreciation is heard again and again in the self-analysis which more and more occupied him. Ralph Waldo Emerson, 1803 to 1882, the famous Transcendentalist, was the son of a Unitarian minister and ordained in the clerical calling himself. A friend and a guide to Fallon, he partially endorsed Fallon's evaluation of the viability of their common Unitarian creed, yet he felt a nearly irreconcilable conflict inherent in the ministerial role. Like Fallon, Emerson couched his argument in sexually connotative terms, although with reverse implications. In his view, the old Calvinist theology, quote, tempts the imagination with a high epic, and better than epic, magnificence, but sounds like nonsense in the ear of understanding, unquote. The Unitarian belief, while intellectually tenable, is effete, quote. Faced with this impossible choice between vitalizing potency based on illusion and debilitating effeminacy grounded on reality, the modern clergyman was paralyzed. He could not be, Emerson concluded, quote, a man quite and whole. Remember the Tom Wolfe book, A Man in Whole. I wonder if it came from that. As chief apostle of the emerging cult of self-confidence, Emerson would spend his life in a complex effort to shut out the voices of self-contempt. He began in 1832 by quitting the ministry. So he moves overtly out of Christianity into self-confidence and self-help, a proto-version of it. During the Civil War, a struggle that called out the deepest anxieties of the largely pacifist liberal clergy, James K. Hosmer, H-O-S-M-E-R, 1834 to 1927, another Unitarian minister, wrote a novel entitled The Thinking Bayonet, which carries Emerson's definition of a clergyman as inherently effeminate to a new and frightening extreme. The Unitarian minister, who is the novel's anti-hero, hovers nervously on the edge of the battlefield and on the edge of the story. He is in every way a non-combatant. The observer figures of Hawthorne, James, or Howells look robust, even strenuous, compared to this frail flower of Unitarian piety, whose last name is appropriately the girlish one of May. Doomed always to a feminine role, May repeatedly contrast himself with his closest friend, a brave and Byronic soldier, the blue-eyed, fair-haired, muscular, thoroughly Saxon hero of the tale. Similarly, the patronymic of this iron-jawed soul is that of the great Southern General Lee. May can only helplessly admire his friend with a wistfulness too deep for envy. He explains his feelings to his sister. To me, he is grand. I think we always like what we do not have ourselves. When he towers over me, little puny fellow that I am, when I hear his strong, rich voice and see him in a boat race, pull till his oar bends like a whipstock, and the people shout, my feeling is almost a hero worship. The woman Lee loves and eventually wins, Leonora Otis, is of a patriotic descent and military spirit. A suitable mate for a Viking, as May describes her. She is the minister's superior in masculinity and rides, the metaphor is his, with flashing eyes and dilating nostrils in Amazonian fashion, roughshod over the masochistic little man. This is the idiom of one suffering such self-doubt that the only viable role he can envision for himself is that of victim. Given Hosmer's apparent estimate of the possibilities of the clerical profession, it is hardly surprising that, like Emerson, he left the ministry for a life of literary and academic pursuits. By 1882, Joseph H. Allen, 1820 to 1898, a Unitarian clergyman of distinguished analytical powers, could write as a statement of simple fact that American Protestantism over the last few generations had relinquished its militant, this is a quote, militant, heroic, aggressive qualities, even while he acknowledged the gains accomplished by the humanistic values Fallon had celebrated 44 years earlier. It is important for the historian to note that Allen's pride in the Unitarian achievement, and he was hardly alone in this, was tentative and partial. The secularization of faith provided a rationale and an impetus for a number of liberal reforms, but it also involved changes and losses, which weighed heavily on many of those concerned. Allen castigated his denomination for exemplifying and disseminating amiable sentimentalism, spiritual impotency, cowardice, and self-indulgence. Significantly, Allen himself, while he did not quit the clergy, redefined and relocated his ministerial role. An introspective man with antiquarian interest, he served as a historian rather than as an active practitioner for his denomination. So all these people are seeing the same thing happening. All these Unitarians are seeing that it's becoming this wimpy, self-indulgent, easy sort of religion from what it used to be. Allen's evasion of his clerical role was part of an increasingly typical pattern of behavior among liberal clergymen who did not, like Emerson or Hosmer, officially leave their pulpits. They de-emphasized their professional prerogatives in ways that would have perplexed and horrified earlier and more stalwart New England ministers. William Ellery Channing, the most famous of the Unitarian ministers in pre-Civil War America, disliked being addressed as Reverend. When a friend once reminded him that he was, after all, a clergyman, he retorted, "Yes, I know it, and always remember the disadvantage." On one occasion, he rebuked his devoted admirer and unpaid secretary, the eccentric but extraordinarily intelligent Elizabeth Peabody, 1804 to 1894, for treating him too formally, too much as a minister. His reprimand was not the sign that Peabody had been at last allowed into the inner sanctum on whose doorstep she had long and assiduously perched. It was rather representative of a deeply felt but generalized public position. In 1841, in an important address on the nature of the church in quotes, Channing denied that a clergyman possessed any special efficacy with God, not vouchsafed to a devout layman. He rejected such an idea as dishonorable to God and totally foreign to the Bible. Channing had some of Fallon's optimism. In part, he was downplaying his ministerial status in order to highlight his human credentials. He disdained to take a head start in the race. Several of Channing's Unitarian contemporaries, and more of his successors, in contrast, experienced their ministerial role as a claustrophobic form of entrapment which cruelly and paradoxically hindered them in the performance of the duties it entailed. Orville Dewey, 1794 to 1882, an artistic, gentle, and supremely literate Unitarian clergyman from New York, could sound like a man dodging his own shadow when he spoke of his clerical function. Traveling away from home, he chose always, quote, not to be known as a clergyman. Like many of his peers, he dropped certain parts of the traditional ministerial costume. He replaced the customary stiff collar with a softer and more secular loose black tie. So again, we see the sartorial echoing the sense, to twist that old line. Sartorial referring to matters of dress. So as the doctrine goes from stiff to soft, so does the collar. Loosens the stays, maybe. On one occasion, in painful conflict with obvious facts, Dewey insisted to a friend, "I am not a clergyman. Stop calling me that. I question our position more and more." Dewey's own commitment to enlightened reform apparently did not allay his anxieties. He felt that as a minister he was, quote, not fairly thrown into the field of life, but rather hedged around with artificial barriers, a sort of moral eunuch. In 1852, Dewey wrote to his talented and equally insecure friend, the novelist and minister William Ware, 1797 to 1852, Minister William Ware, about his experience. Dewey writing about his experience to Ware, as a visiting clergyman in Washington, D.C., quote, "The gaiety passed him by. The politics passed him by. Nobody wants him. Nobody holds him by the button but some desperate, dilapidated philanthropist. People say, while turning a corner, 'How do you do, doctor?' Which is very much as if they said, 'How do you do, abstraction?' Dewey fears his profession has consigned him to an invisibility, to unreality. In his country's capital, he is a cipher." Even allowing for Dewey's constitutional timidity, how does one explain his self-depreciation in the light of Alexis de Tocqueville's considered observation, made only two short decades before, that the American clergy possessed immense power, quote-unquote? To explain this discrepancy, one needs to examine the situation facing the American ministry during this period and the differing responses available to different denominations. For it was precisely the ministers like Joseph Allen, James Hosmer, and Orville Dewey, members of the older, once state-supported, northern non-evangelical denominations, who faced the most severe questioning of their economic, political, and cultural preeminence amid the turbulent religious developments of the first half of the 19th century. In what seemed a flush tide of American Protestantism, they often appeared the laggards, hesitant promulgators of feminine virtues in an era of militant masculinity, strangers in the promised land. And that's the end of the first subtitle. So she's basically proved by citing various Unitarians and similar that they clearly themselves felt that they were becoming effeminate and kind of a joke, impotent, eunuchs, all this kind of language is used as they move from the front and center to the periphery of American life, and they feel it. And they feel about themselves, it seems, the way many others do, that they're more than mildly absurd. And I think we'll leave it right there of this first subtitle having been completed in chapter one. It's a long chapter. We don't need to go. If we go all the way through, it'll take several hours. So I think we'll break it up there. We got the basic idea established that this religion has really been softened up, and not just in the view of the outsiders, but of the view of the men actually formally working in and at the head of the very profession or calling. So we'll wrap it up on page 23, and we'll pick up next time with the second subtitle, Disestablishment. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I'm Alex Linder. Everything that we do is part of the Learning College, and Vanguard audiobooks can be found at vnnforum.com in our audiobooks thread in the massive section. So thanks for listening. I'll be back with you again real soon.